Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest. Life comes at you fast, which is why it's important to find some time to relax. A little you time. Enter Chumba Casino. With no download required, you can jump on anytime, anywhere for the chance to redeem some serious prizes. So treat yourself with Chumba Casino and play over 100 online casino-style games, all for free. Go to ChumbaCasino.com to collect your free welcome bonus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
In December 2019, paramedics responded to a call from a father who'd found his 10-year-old son unresponsive. What they discovered at that property in Dayton, Ohio, would lead to the launch of a murder investigation and the uncovering of one of the worst child abuse cases in US history. This is the story of a child whose every waking moment was filled with pain and fear. This is the murder of Dakota Collins. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. It hurts me when I come across a case that I cannot compute. And there are so many that I struggle to compute, but there are some that are so astonishingly dreadful that they take my understanding of evil to a totally new paradigm and universe. And the story of Dakota Collins absolutely marries up with that belief system that I hold. When I researched this case, I felt a mix of distress, rage, a desire for retribution that was hard to contain. And I know that for a lot of you, whenever we cover child abuse cases on this channel, it evokes personal memories of your own abuse. It triggers agonies from the past, and it provokes a sense of righteous rage that feels to some degree as it has no place to go because we can't control what happens to the individuals who carried out this heinous atrocity that I'm going to talk about today. So just to acknowledge before I start talking about this story, it is hard. It's also really important. We have to carry the legacies of these children who are lost so that we in time learn to prevent them. As you know, this will be a hard watch, but I hope you will, because Dakota Collins deserves every single one of us to have eyes on what he endured. He needs to be remembered as the child who deserves so much more. And we need to learn from events like this so that hopefully in the future we can prevent further cases like this. Let me take you back to the 13th of December, 2019. Emergency services, they receive a call, and this call comes from Al Mutahan McLean. Now, he tells the dispatcher on the phone that the reason that he's calling is because he's found his 10-year-old son, Dakota Collins, unresponsive. Now, we can all agree this is unusual. An unresponsive child is fortunately very unusual in our society. It's as simple as that. But it does happen, and you can imagine the horror for most parents if they find their child in an unresponsive state. Now, when the paramedics arrive, and you have to imagine where the mindset of the adult in this scenario would be if they had found their 10-year-old child unresponsive. You don't even have to have kids to imagine that experience. You can have a cat and a dog, and if you found them unresponsive, you know exactly what would happen. It would be blind panic, sheer horror, desperation. And while some people handle that by withdrawing and being very quiet, others, like myself, for example, in such circumstances may well find themselves hysterical. There is an expectation of emotional congruence with a situation. And when that fails to occur, it sparks suspicion absolutely immediately. And you have to remember that when somebody is trying to feign a particular emotion, equally that stands out in the same way as somebody with a lack of emotion. There are expected responses to certain scenarios. And without a doubt, from the get-go, Takoda's father isn't acting according to these expectations. So he's waiting outside the property when the services arrive. Why would you be doing that? The most obvious behaviour, if you've got a child that's potentially very unwell or dead, you are going to be with that child, probably hollering, screaming, begging for help, doing anything you can, because the most important piece of your experience and person is lying in an unresponsive state. But that's not how this plays out. He's just waiting outside. So then they go in and they find Takoda just lying alone and unresponsive on the living room floor. This is completely outside the realms of reality and normality when we think about the situation unfolding. Now, for these paramedics, I cannot imagine how traumatic finding a child in this state is anyway. You can train all your lives to work with people who are injured, dying, in dreadful situations, but coming across an unresponsive child lying alone on a living room floor at the age of 10 years of age is going to be something that stays with you throughout your professional career. I genuinely believe that. And they're desperate to try to bring this child round. They're attempting life-saving procedures on Takoda. But whilst this is going on, McLean is just outside with a police officer. And what is he doing? Is he moaning about the horror that he's enduring? Is he screaming about the helplessness he feels as his baby is lying on that floor? No. He's just complaining. He's literally, whilst his child is having life-saving measures attended, the reality is that this man is outside speaking to a police officer just saying about how hard it's been for him. He says that Takoda's been a really badly behaved, difficult child, and basically is just insinuating that he's the victim. Seriously, guys, throughout this, be ready for this excuse of a human per se, let alone a father. I don't even like relating to this heinous human being as a parent of any standard. I have to because there is a relational issue there. But this man cares only for himself. We'll say that from the get-go. And I think the profound reality of that statement is going to come so clear to you as I tell this particular tale. Now, Takoda at this point is dead. And paramedics have tried to resuscitate him. They've tried to attend those life-saving measures. They've tried to bring him round and it's failed. So they indicate that he's dead. And you know what McLean responds? All right, I tried to get you guys here as fast as I could. This statement is at such a juxtaposition of any parental experience in a moment where you've been told your child is dead. It's not a defense mechanism that's required. No one's going to have that in that moment, defense mechanism of, oh, it's not my fault. I tried to get you here as quickly as I could. I failed. He's dead. But at the end of the day, not on me. So we're immediately going into defense mode. Now, the reality there is you only defend a scenario that potentially you feel you could be accused of or that you're aware that you've continued to carry out. So he is essentially, as far as I'm concerned, admitting guilt and culpability in that statement. I appreciate it could be argued, well, no, he's just trying to defend the fact that he's failed to make it so that his child has survived. But for me, absolutely, if your first port of call is, hey, it's not my fault, I'm already deeply suspicious of that. Psychologically, a parent in a position where a child has died within their care, the most common feeling is absolute guilt. It doesn't matter that you had no opportunity to save your child. Let's say a child has dealt with an infection, it's been misdiagnosed, and they've died of sepsis at home in spite of all of your care. And it's the failures of another system and service that actually created that. The parent feels this intolerable agony and guilt. They're not saying, it's not my fault, I didn't realize they had sepsis. They're usually saying, oh my God, what more could I have done? McLean doesn't do that. It's all about he's a victim and it's not his fault. Also, those who saw him at the scene said one of the things that really stood out to them was he just didn't seem concerned. He was more concerned about himself. Now, of course, they have to deal with Dakota's body, so they take him to Dayton Children's Hospital, and it's here that he's officially pronounced dead soon after he actually arrives at the hospital. Now, as I've said, from the get-go, the emergency responders are incredibly suspicious. I mean immediately suspicious about how Dakota has died, because as soon as they start attending to this child at the emergency scene, they can see there are some severe injuries that it seems this child has incurred. So his body is literally covered in hundreds of bruises, lacerations, and they reported, in fact, that he had numerous injuries indicative of being severely beaten. That was the quote. Basically, if I'm going to put it in layman's terms, guys, he was battered from head to toe. And he was bruised from his skin all the way to his bone. I've covered cases before where we've talked about that level of bruising, where it's so repetitive and it's so ingrained that the bruising literally goes all the way through. Now, we all appreciate that children don't have a lot of flesh. They're little children. So clearly it's slightly different from bruising in adulthood. But nonetheless, imagine the amount of power, the amount of aggression that is required to sustain an injury where all the way through from your skin to your literal bone, the bruising is there entirely. Even the entirety of his scalp was deeply bruised. They also found what they felt were letters that appeared to be branded on his back. And many of the injuries that they found on Dakota's body were actually old injuries, so it was showing that he had sustained abuse over a long period of time. Another thing that I just find really upsetting is that there were loads of defensive injuries. So this child, this 10-year-old kid, and he was gorgeous. He was a delightful looking child. And I know that any child is beautiful, but when you see pictures of this smiling, gorgeous kid, of which so many of us right now would open our homes to make safe, to make them feel loved, to remind them of the worth, to imagine that they suffered defensive injuries because at 10 years of age and before, they're trying to fight off their attacker in their own home is astonishingly dire. So now they've seen all these injuries, they launch a murder investigation because they know straight away there is absolutely no way that this child has died under any normal circumstance. Now, the subsequent autopsy concluded what we would expect, an absolute raft of horror injuries. So Dakota had died due to multiple injuries, which included multiple blunt force injuries, compressive asphyxia and water submersion in a bath. And at some point before his death, he'd either been submerged in a bath and held underwater, or they believed he'd been forced potentially to drink excessive amounts of water. They were able to find that there were just deep layers of bruising all the way through the layers of his neck muscle and directly over the spine. Just imagine the amount of power that injuries had been caused by. And for those of you who kind of want to know what that would actually mean, as in what that deep bruising through all the layers of the neck muscle directly over the spine would kind of be like for those doing the autopsy, they actually said that the injuries that they actually were able to discover, they're usually only ever seen after really catastrophic events. So serious car accidents are a really good descriptor of when you'd see these kind of horrific injuries. And also, another thing that they discovered to their horror is there's evidence of a very serious sexual assault. So they find injuries, lacerations and bruising to the anal area. This is a 10-year-old boy, guys, I'm describing. A 10-year-old boy. And where the anus was, those lacerations, they weren't surface, they weren't minor, we're talking lacerations that continued deep into the rectum. It's a 10-year-old little boy. So the evidence, when they looked at that, it suggested that Dakota had basically suffered a very violent, very brutal death. But the death is only a part of it, isn't it? This is the end, to some degree, of that little boy's suffering. But the origin, well, that happened a long time before. And often when we focus on the death, we miss out on the reality of what led up to it and what this little child, this little boy, that, as I say, so many of us would have welcomed with open arms into our world. What he endured is one of the most horrific sustained periods of abuse that I have ever come across. And I have come across personally and worked with personally individuals who have dealt with brutal abuse. But this, it's astonishingly dreadful. It really is. That this little boy led this brutal life of torture. Let's talk about Dakota for a minute. So Dakota Collins was born on the 18th of December 2008. His mother was called Robin Collins and father McLean and her, they actually had separated. And at this point, Robin had, as happens in lots of cases, been awarded main custody. Now, when he was with his mum, and she's imperfect, I'm going to say that now. We're going to get that out of the way. She's imperfect. We'll talk about that in a minute. But he seemed happy. He genuinely did. He lived with her in Wisconsin. And when you look at the photos that are taken of him at the time, he looks healthy. He's smiling. And clearly, even though it's an imperfect situation, it's a far better situation than where he ends up by a billion miles. I will say, he will have had a dysfunctional upbringing. There's no way he couldn't have had, because Robin had her personal demons. She dealt with really serious dependency. She had substance abuse issues, and they included heroin addiction. So anybody out there who's worked in this field or has had experience with people who are heroin dependents, or if you yourself have been a heroin dependent, you will know that dependency is a very painful emotional experience. You might be self-medicating your own trauma, you might be dealing with emotional pain, but the reality is it takes you away from doing anything else, because you are so desperate to connect with escaping it that you then find heroin again and again and again to deal with that pain that you're trying to medicate, meaning that the cycle is that you prioritize the heroin and not the rest of your world. Doesn't make you a terrible person, just means that you can't be as present for the people that you wish to love as you would ideally be. And certainly for Dakota being brought up in this situation, it's not going to be ideal. His mum can't be as present emotionally, physically, socially, environmentally, or any of those psychological facets that are required to be a great parent. Doesn't mean that she's a terrible human in any way, shape, or form. I would have taken Dakota even on her worst day and put him with her, knowing that he would have been safer there than where he ended up, without a shadow of a doubt. Now, in spite of those pictures where he is happy and smiling, and like I said, there were certainly happy times, I think, with his mother, Robin, there was a massive dysfunction in the family. So Robin had her personal demons. She struggled with serious substance abuse, and these substances included heroin. Now, if you are somebody with a heroin dependency, your priority list is not your child. Your priority list is getting your next hit. So without a doubt, Dakota would have been less important than he should have been by a mile. And actually, she does spend time in jail for abusing him. So this little boy is being brought into a world where his parents are dysfunctional anyway, where his mother is a dependent, and where he's dealing with some abuse in his life. Now, that happened in 2009, and she actually subsequently faced further criminal convictions because of her drug addiction. So he's being brought up in these really, I would say, unsympathetic, unenviable surroundings. And that doesn't mean that Robin wasn't the better parent to be with that child, because believe me, in comparison, she was a saint. But poor Dakota, right from the get-go, his life is full of failings of the adults who should have been there to protect their child. So we get to 2013. This is when Dakota's around 5 years of age. Robin actually loses custody of him. Now, his father, McLean, he ultimately gets awarded full custody of Dakota. Now, when he actually gets custody of Dakota, he should stay in the state that his ex is in. This happens all the time. There are so many people who want to move away. I actually might have wanted to move away when I had my little boys and I was a single mom. But the reality is that you have to make sure that there is access for the other parent, and rightly so. The fact that Dakota's father, when he gets custody, moves completely out of state, we're talking 500 miles out of state, basically meaning that he cuts off any physical contact with Robin and Dakota, is something I find really wrong. I actually feel that the court should intervene in these situations because that is not in the best interest of the child. And what does that tell you about McLean? It tells you that he's selfish. It tells you that the needs of the child are not number one. It tells you that he suits and meets his own needs before considering that of his child. And this child needs a parent who is considering Dakota's needs first. But I wouldn't be telling this story if any of the waste of space that come into this little boy's life had ever done a job that was half reasonable. So Dakota is taken by his father to live with McLean and his girlfriend. She's 28-year-old Amanda Hines. I'm going to have to control a lot of swearing in this video because even now, the stuff I want to say about these excuses for humans is, I think, something that could get me banned from YouTube. So they moved to Dayton, Ohio. Like I said, it's 500 miles away from his mother. And they also live with Hines's sister, also known as, I'm a massive waste of space. I'm stealing air that other people could be breathing. Yeah, 25-year-old Jennifer Ebert moves in, and this is how they live together. Now later, a 3-year-old child actually also moves into the property, and that is McLean's brother. So this is a child that's brought into the family, and Hines and McLean take custody of this child. And this is at the same property that the paramedics have found Dakota dead. So the picture that you're seeing is a very imperfect world for this child anyway. It also makes me go, do they just give children to anyone? There's a 3-year-old boy just handed over because he's got a blood relation with this man. What kind of checks were done on McLean? Because it would take me about, I don't know, 3 seconds to realise he's not right, you should not be around children, but who am I to judge? Anyway, McLean gets brought in for questioning after Dakota's been found, and they immediately detain him in a holding cell, rightfully so, because they know he's a massive murderer. They then start to question him, and I've watched the interviews, and I try to remain objective when I'm watching them so that I can refer the information and also put certain extracts in. But what I really want to say is, from pretty much a minute into it, I felt incandescent with rage. I really did. This man does not care at all for this child who has died. All he is concerned about is creating an absolute web of lies to explain the destruction of this poor boy. So he starts getting questioned, and he tells the police he's in shock. He has no idea how his son died. Says, that's the thing. I still don't know if my child's dead. I still don't know. They just told me he's dead, but they didn't tell me what killed him or anything like that.
Yeah. I don't want to agree to that right now. That man just bopped me in my shit and told me I did it. So I feel that was pressure right there. I wanted to speak immediately.
You what?
I said, I feel like he pressured me.
Okay. But are you wanting to talk to us now? You
yes.
have that right.
Yes, I do.
Okay, but is that by choice?
Because yes, I want to know what's going on. I want to know what happened to my child.
Okay, we want to know too.
So he's just, again, setting up this idea that he's his victim. He has no clue. He doesn't understand what's happening. It's that, why don't I act real dumb? Why don't I seem like, how could this possibly have happened? I've had nothing to do with it. Look how dumb I am. I mean, with respect, he is dumb. But that's the only synchronicity in that statement. During the interview, he rambles a great deal, and it tends to be about how difficult it's been for him. It's really difficult for me to look after a 10-year-old child. And he says, you know, the reason why it's so difficult is because my child just intentionally injures himself. And that's right.
I ain't slept in about 3 days, right? The kid keep falling down the stairs, keep knocking his head around. It looked like something was wrong with his stomach last night that I noticed. And I gave him some water to throw up. You know what I mean? I had him drink, like, several cups of water because it looked very odd normal. And I know that he used to eat in his own shit. So I just wanted to make sure that he was okay. So he drank the water. That was it. And I guess he goes back upstairs and acting out some more. I mean, jumping off the banister, shitting everywhere, pissing everywhere, the usual, might I add. I've been dealing with this for probably like since he was 2 years old. He's been doing this. Yeah. And so I've been very tired. I ain't slept in 3 days. So I'm just sitting there. And here he come rolling down the stairs again. Ba-doom, ba-doom.
Basically tries to blame Dakota for his own death. I mean, any of us with children out there will know if we aren't protecting our children constantly, they're always attacking themselves because, you know, they like causing themselves pain, said no parent ever about their kid. But this is what he's saying. So he's trying to explain away all the cuts, the bruises, the lacerations on Dakota's body. And one of the things that he said was that Dakota would just like run downstairs, just bang his head against the walls and bang his head against the doors. Now, for those of you who are listening and watching, who maybe have had experience of working or actually having a child in your home who has a serious developmental issue or disability, certainly. And also for those of you who've seen children who are in wheelchairs wearing helmets or they're walking around with parents wearing helmets, that's because there are certain conditions and certain scenarios where a child will, due to emotional distress, bang their heads against the wall. But we know that a child who is considered developmentally normal, and Dakota is typical, he's a typical developmental child, this kind of behaviour, I don't know, is non-existent, but also, should it happen, should a child roll downstairs and bang their head against the wall purposely, there's going to be a high level of emotional distress. That child is struggling massively and would require attention. It's not typical behaviour at all. And if a child kept doing this, you would have some serious reasoning to immediately inform the authorities, the hospital, because this would be considered very dangerous and also would be indicative of something very deep. It could be that the child has got something in their brain occurring, such as a tumour, because it's not normal. But for Dakota's excuse for a father, he's portraying that this is all behavioural. Dakota's injuring himself behaviorally because he likes the impact that it has. He likes causing distress to the adult caregivers. I use that word very loosely. And McLean does admit at this point that he does keep his son in the attic. But again, it's not because he's a bad dad. It's just because Dakota's so difficult and he can't control his behaviour and he can't control his bowel movements that the way to manage this is to put him in the attic. I kid you not, Dakota's three brain cell for a father said this, literally said, that he's locking him in the attic because he's defecating and he can't deal with the fact that this child is behaving in this way. And he's refusing as well, is what he's saying. He's got an inability or refusal, so again, behavioural, to actually manage his bowel movements. And instead of, again, dealing with this horrific reality, if it was happening, because again, it would suggest that a child was in acute distress, he just locks him in the attic, because that's the way of separating him from the other people in the home. This actually happened. We're talking about a 10-year-old little boy. And this man, even to the police, feels that this admission is no big deal. Then we have him in the interview trying to explain away the evidence of this absolutely serious anal rape. Dakota suffered this anal rape just before he died. And this is how Dakota's father explains it away. He said that he had a habit of inserting a broken wooden chair leg into his anus. Honestly, that's what he said. He tells the police that Dakota actively chose to ram a painfully large, incredibly solid chair leg into his anus. It's unbelievable that this animal thought that it was acceptable to suggest that this child is electing to do this. And he told the police that's the kind of stuff he was into. So number one, he sexualized the child in that moment. It's not me. It's not my problem. This kid's sexually deviant. He's actually anally raping himself with this object. And he's actually suggesting that Dakota was part of that issue, that he was choosing that issue. He was using it because it was satisfying. That is not what a 10-year-old child would ever do in the history of children. Because one, it's unbelievably painful. Two, it's unbelievably damaging. And three, he's 10. He is 10.
I ain't never sexually harassed my child or do nothing like that. That's homophobic. And I mean, that's homo, and I ain't far from gay, you know what I mean? I ain't never played with they private parts. You see my little brother, correct? Healthy as an ox. We give him the same treatment. One just chooses to eat his food, and the other one chooses to eat his shit. And I mean, he got fed 3-4 times a day. He would take 10 hours, 20 hours to eat his food. Yep, I mean it. There it is, 20 hours to eat a bowl of noodles. How is he supposed to gain weight? Or how is he supposed to be healthy? You know what I mean? Non-stop. So I'm dealing with that on top of the fact that we ain't got no health insurance. Because he done got in trouble so damn much to the point where I can't leave the house for 2 minutes or not 1 minute without worrying about is he killing himself, hurting himself, doing what he's doing. I really don't know why my child is dead right now. I still don't know.
And then this, on top of what he's just said to these police officers about what he considers Dakota's deviancy, without even being asked to further explain it, he inserts the fact that he, as a human being, is far from gay. So now again, he's sexualizing Dakota. He's saying that Dakota is a gay child because he's using that chair leg to apparently pleasure himself. I mean, this is so easy to pick apart that it doesn't even deserve analysis because you are all aware of how disgusting, despicable, and reprehensible what I'm saying is. But it does completely illuminate the kind of mindset that Dakota's father has. And for those detectives, you can imagine hearing it, that they must have had to control and contain themselves. So he claims on the day that Dakota died, he'd actually fought to keep that chair leg in his anus and that he'd been forced as the adult to wrestle it out. I cannot describe the pictures I have at the moment of what I would like to do with that chair leg to Dakota's father. Just give me half an hour in a room with the entire chair. I'm sure I can think of some, I don't know, inventive ways to use it. But this idea that he's got to wrestle this chair leg off this little boy is ridiculous. This man is a grown-ass adult. He could easily take this chair leg from this child. And also, if there is an issue where your child is constantly apparently inserting a chair leg in their anus, you would remove the chair leg. You would remove the chair because you wouldn't want that child at risk. We know it's absolute bullshit, but the point is, this is the picture he's painting, and it's all deriding his son, his dead son. All he is doing is trying to distort the reality of this child's torture and make him responsible for his own death. He actually also then goes on to talk about the fact that Dakota regularly ate his own feces. Now, one thing I will say again, because some of you will have children or have experience of working with kids who do eat their own feces, it does happen, particularly if children are on the very, very developmentally disabled end of the autistic spectrum. We do see this, and part of that is because of the sensory experience of the smell and the taste. Now, to people who are, shall we say, neurotypical, the reality is that causes deep aversion, and it should do, because eating poo is something that can cause us a great deal of problems because it's very bad for our gut, because it's full of the nasties, so to speak. If you're a child who doesn't have the understanding of that, then unfortunately at times we do see children doing this. It's why Houdini suits exist, for example, which is what you put your baby in when they're very little, if they can get out of things because they go into the nappy and they eat the poo. It does happen. It's very, 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 very rare. And again, we wouldn't see it in a child like Dakota. But he's telling this story that this child is actively and willingly eating his own feces. Now, throughout the interrogation, McLean constantly says, I've got no idea how my son died. No idea whatsoever. This is one of the things that he actually comes out with. He said, Dad, help. And I came upstairs, and that's why I'm shocked. In this spot right now, not crying or nothing, I'm just like in shock. Like, my child's really dead. Now, I know them girls didn't do nothing to them. Kill him. I mean, I just don't understand. So if we're going to unpick that, what can we see in that particular statement? First of all, he's trying to suggest, hey, the girls who live with me, they're not guilty. So he's trying to defend their presence by saying, I know that they did nothing. I mean, I did nothing, but they did nothing. That's one. Number two, I don't know why I'm not crying. I don't know why I'm not like seeming human. It's just because I'm so shocked. That's why I'm not crying or nothing. No, you're not crying or nothing because you have literally no emotional attachment to the child that you've murdered. And therefore, it's difficult for somebody like you to actually elicit an emotion that you don't feel. And that's the concern here, that in a scenario where he would absolutely be on the floor, for a start, if my kid had just died and I'd been brought in for questioning, you better be ready for a hell of a scene. Because I'm going to be screaming at those investigators, take me to my child. I'm not talking to you. Take me to my child. Because my concern is not going to be their questions. My concern is going to be what the hell has happened to my kid. If I'm not responsible for that scenario, that's what's going to be going on. That's a psychological reality. It's a proficiency that we have as a parent. Our desire is to be with our child. That's not happening. It's all defensive. It's all blame. And it's all excuse. And this is when he introduces a fact as well. That he knows, without a doubt, that the two women that he lives with weren't involved. But he's playing that, I don't know what happened, I just don't understand it. Well, we do, and so would any small child, because you're coming across like a pathological, psychopathic liar, just throwing it in there. Now, McLean's girlfriend, this is Hines, and her sister, Ebert, they also get arrested, of course they do, they get questioned by the police. They've both been living with Takoda at the time of his death and before for a long period, essentially, as far as his life is concerned. Now, actually, one of the things that the police said was really, really ironic when they went and arrested Eva is that she was wearing this shirt, and it was actually a cartoon design with the phrase on it, I'd help, but I don't want to. I want that on her grave, if she's allowed a grave. If we don't just, you know, cremate her body and feed it to the fish, just throwing it out there. Maybe we don't even need to cremate her body. Just pop her overboard. More environmentally friendly, I think, isn't it? Anyway, that would be her epitaph. I'd help, but I don't want to. And this is going to be so accurate when it comes down to the description of her behaviour in relation to this little boy's life and death. So they start questioning one of the women. And when the questioning begins, it's as if Takoda's father knows that this is a problem, that at the end of the day, he's in this cell and McLean is acutely aware that this is the point where one of them could break. Because bear in mind, they may have been witness to what's happened to this little boy, but they haven't actually physically been involved. So if you're going to cut a deal, damn straight you're going to cut a deal by hanging McLean, because you're going to imagine, I don't want to go down for this. I know what's happened. I need to sing like a bird to make sure that I'm not going to be the one going down for life. And he must know that he has to put himself in their minds. So when they start questioning one of the women, he starts making all of this loud banging sounds in his cell. And that's a psychological connector. It's saying, I'm here. Don't forget your loyalty. I'm here. Remind yourself that I am here. So that's why he does it. So it's like making noises like metal on concrete. So the two officers go to his cell and he's actually holding a chair. And they said that when they went in, it did actually look like he was gonna swing at them. They did have this physical altercation. I'm kind of imagining in that physical altercation that hopefully the police officers got some blows in directly to his eyes and nose. I'm not saying that happened. I mean, all I'm saying is that if you do have a altercation with police officers, it would be an appropriate measure for you to find that you get a little bit bruised and beaten. Is it just me hoping for that? So this physical altercation ensues. It only lasts about half a minute, and actually all three of them end up on the floor, and at this point they're able to handcuff McLean. He did actually, when I checked the notes, sustain a cut to his lip, and he did end up getting checked over at hospital. which I don't know whether he deserved, really. He caused it. Should just have locked him back up in the cell. Now, whilst he is at hospital getting checked over, he starts talking to himself, and a detective actually overhears him saying, he must have drowned because I didn't beat his butt that bad today. So this detective actually hears him basically admitting that he's died and he can't figure out quite why he's died, because he's thinking about the fact that he has beat him, but he's not beating him as hard today. So it couldn't possibly be the beating, could it? I mean, that in itself just demonstrates how toxic this human is. Now, Ebert, the sister, in this scenario, during interrogation, you won't be surprised, broke first. I mean, we can all predict this, can't we? McLean predicts it without a doubt. You can imagine sitting down as the sister thinking, oh, I've had nothing to do with this. And the police saying, you just need to tell us the truth. Or I don't know, you're going to go down for a long time. And she's like, oh, all that loyalty, I have none. Ironically, when it comes down to the interrogation, the I'd help, but I don't want to kind of thing changes, because she does want to help, because she's thinking about her own future. And her morals are so low that she has no alliances with anybody but herself. So she begins to tell the story, and I imagine without a shadow of a doubt that she misguidedly believes that she can admit to knowing that all this abuse was happening and just tell the truth in that situation without necessarily being culpable. How wrong you are. How wrong you are, Ibert. How wrong you are. You see, the problem is, if you're seeing child cruelty and you do nothing about it, then you're culpable. You are literally culpable for this reality. So she breaks, she starts talking about what can only be described as absolutely horrific abuse in detail, talking about what Dakota suffered at his father's hands, and she just goes through it. Now, first of all, she makes it absolutely 100% clear that she had nothing to do with it, so that she didn't harm him, Hines didn't harm him, they'd not physically laid hands on that little boy. So she's wrongly thinking again that this means that she's done nothing wrong. But she was so open about what can only be described as the living hell that that little boy's daily life had been, that from the get-go, there was absolutely no way that she was going to be walking away from this. All it was going to demonstrate was the malevolence, the willingness to allow this little child to be tortured on a daily basis without any intervention, just standing by, watching, encouraging. In fact, she was one of the gatekeepers of his abuse, because whenever Dakota strayed from the absolute laws and rules imposed on him, no matter how grotesque and tortuous they were, she would alert McLean. She would tell him so that she could then watch that child being horribly abused. So the police interrogate all three of the co-defendants, and at this point, officers are able to build a really dire picture of this regime of horrific abuse that McLean has subjected his son to. I mean, this is abuse we're talking about that he suffered for years. So when they're able to trace back when this began, it seems it started in 2015. Now, this is when Dakota is 7 years of age. It also has this connection to some degree where it coincides with the time that McLean and Hines take custody of McLean's three-year-old brother. So it's like, at that moment in time, the brother starts to become the favoured child. And one can say, well, why is that? Now, we see in families constantly one child being horrifically abused, whereas other children are treated well. Part of that is a defense mechanism of the abuser. If you treat one child or two child or three children well, and then you hurt one of them, then the other three children will defend you and say, well, that parent's a great parent. And that makes it very difficult for social services. So there is actually a method in the madness when they do that. Now, there are lots of reasons why McLean and Hines will treat Dakota differently, potentially, to the three-year-old brother. First of all, the three-year-old brother does not have any ties with McLean's relationship past. So resentment, hostility, bitterness to an ex-partner, and what Dakota represents, for example, in their life because of the ex-partner and the relationship, that does not occur where the three-year-old brother is. So it's a more pure relationship as far as they're concerned. Hines may well feel annoyed that Dakota represents a time that she wasn't present in McLean's life. McLean may carry resentment and hostility from the prior relationship, and therefore Dakota gets the brunt of that. When the three-year-old brother arrives, they essentially compartmentalize that this child is a good child and Dakota is a bad child. And the brother basically becomes the favored child in the relationship. And this is when, at the same time, Dakota just becomes this target of relentless abuse. Now, in January that year, Dakota had started at Horace Mann Elementary School. And the staff are quite astute. First of all, they realise that he stinks. He's always smelling really strongly of urine and feces. I mean, these are massive red flags. This is what we look for in abuse. When a child is being treated like that at home, that's what they're willing to let you see. My God, what's going on behind closed doors? They also said that he had these haircuts, and these haircuts looked like they must have been really, really painful. They were really terrible. They made this little boy look disheveled. And the reason for this is that McLean gave him those hairstyles because he wanted him to be ridiculed at school. That's what he wanted. He wanted to ensure that his life at school represented a reflection of his life at home too. I cannot tell you what I wish to do to McLean, but I think you can all envisage in your mind exactly how it would play out if we got a little bit of time with him. The staff were so concerned about this pungent smell of this poor child that they actually washed his clothes, they tried to keep him clean, and what did McLean do? He got angry. That's right. When they tried to tidy up this poor kid, to show this child care, to remind this child that they noticed and that he had worth, McLean was angry. Even told them that Dakota wasn't even allowed to see the school nurse for any reason. I, at this point, would be personally removing said child from school and taking them home and saying, they're not coming within 100 metres of you, but apparently that's not legal, but that's what I would do. So Dakota ends up getting subjected to just extreme emotional, physical and sexual abuse. McLean's sadistic treatment of this little boy beggars belief. And I'm going to take you through what his life was like, because we need to understand the warrior level of this child. I mean it. The fact that I'm talking about Dakota's death doesn't represent who that child was. What this child put up with is a level of survival and resilience that I cannot, in my years being alive, even contemplate, let alone have lived through. But that little boy lived through it for 3 years without a doubt. And that little boy survived the unsurvivable. And it's not just the death that was unsurvivable. I mean, the life he lived was unsurvivable at times. And I don't know how he found the strength of character, the ability to stay alive and to do the horrific things he was told he had to do. He's an amazing little boy. What a loss to this world. So McLean subjected him to horrific torture regularly. He was beaten by his dad on a daily basis. He threw him about, he kicked him, he punched him, he body slammed him, as in full pelt. He wasn't doing it as if this was a child. He was doing this as if he was taking on another adult. He used a metal spatula to hit him. Also, he'd particularly have this affinity with using hot sauce. So he'd get the hot sauce and he'd pour it all over his buttocks and his anus. And he'd also strangle Dakota at times. But I'd say there was one form of torture that really took precedence over the others. So McLean had this particular enjoyment of torturing Dakota by making him stand in really unnatural and awkward positions, a torture pose essentially. And he'd make that little boy do it for up to 20 hours a day. So one of the positions would, he'd make Dakota bend over, then he'd have to touch his toes in that bent over position and his legs would be crossed. Or he'd have to hold a bag full of books. This is for 20 hours a day. Just think about the muscle cramps alone. It would have been absolutely unbearable. Now add that to all of the years of sustained abuse and neglect. I I cannot imagine the agony. I can't imagine the daily agony of this little boy. When Cody would come home from school, that's how he spent his evenings. Whereas so many kids just take it for granted that they can come in, get the homework out of the way, get the scruffs on, go out and play with the mates, sit in front of the TV, just feeling safe. Whether they're rich or poor, feeling safe because they're loved, because they know that they've got a parent caring for them. Dakota had exactly the opposite. I can't imagine when he was going home from school, on the days he was at school, knowing what he was going to face and endure and silently putting up with it because he was so scared, because he was so afraid. In fact, when it got to the weekends, that's how he would often spend his weekend, just in those torture poses. And McLean was so diabolical, so depraved, so disgusting, so sadistic and enjoying of that sadism that he actually installed security cameras so they could monitor Coda from the comfort of their living room or their beds. Oh yeah, they were lazy ass people. So they didn't even want to have to be present whilst they checked on whether the child was doing what they were being told to do. They just lay in bed or sat on the couch and just watched so they could make sure that if he dared to stray from that torture position or he dared to lie down because of his exhausted little broken body, they could further punish him. If he stopped performing any of that harsh punishment I've just talked about, his father would go back and beat him again. And Hines and Ebert, they all alerted McLean whenever that little boy dared to break that pose. And when McLean would return, he would severely beat Dakota. And Ebert and Hines just watched. In fact, they were fully invested in the abuse. That's how I describe it. They were fully invested in that little boy's abuse. And it's horrific to think that people on the outside, they saw Hines as a mother figure to Dakota. It's unbelievable that that bitch was happily encouraging abuse, ensuring it occurred regularly. And yet on the outside, she's getting lauded as this lovely mum who's taken on this child. Now, Dakota's maternal grandmother, she'd actually unsuccessfully tried to get custody of that little boy in 2013. My God, if only she had been granted custody. But during this time, Hines had the audacity, the pathology, as far as I'm concerned, where she can just lie to somebody's face, where she was happy to reassure the maternal grandmother that she'd look after him as if he were her own. She really doesn't deserve ever to be called a mother. She really doesn't deserve to ever be considered maternal in any way, shape or form. What she did to this little boy. What's even worse is that, heartbreakingly, Dakota referred to her as mum. How dare she have let that little boy call her mum? That's just such a privileged position. She stole that title. She was a squatter in that role. It wasn't real. She doesn't deserve ever to have had that child mutter those words towards her. Hines was somebody who wasn't always in the house, I'll give her that. She was out working a lot, but she had therefore every opportunity to go and get help. That's the thing that really drives me mad about this. You know, at the end of the day, this woman was in and out, she was working, she could have alerted the authorities, she could have talked to the police, she could have escaped. She wasn't in a coercively controlled situation or relationship. She had every chance to free this child from the torture that he had imposed on him by her absolute excuse of a partner, but she did nothing. And Ebba, her sister, well, she takes the biscuit as far as I'm concerned here, because she was an absolute waste of space, flappy appendage of a nobody, because at the end of the day, she didn't even have a job. She was at the property all the time, you know, where she wasn't sleeping, because life's so hard when you do nothing. So she was available 24/7 to help that kid. But all she did was use that time to help torture Dakota. In fact, she later admitted that when Dakota stopped doing whatever the torture pose was, she considered it disrespectful behavior. She said he wasn't doing what he was told. So she got to a point where, because he broke those poses because of the agony, she just stopped speaking to him. He was just utterly alone. Think about that. How dehumanizing is it? She gets to a point where she can in her head balance this absolutely despicable reality for this child. And she can say, well, he deserves it. I mean, she's been brought up. It's never happened to her, that kind of level of abuse. And yet she can somehow believe that the punishments that he's getting on a daily basis for doing nothing wrong is acceptable. And then because she has to balance that in her brain, as opposed to starting to say to herself, this is too much, this is wrong, I need to do something about it, she starts to further dehumanize him so it makes it acceptable. Oh, Dakota isn't a child. Dakota's this disrespectful, misbehaving individual that I can separate from being a child. He's deserving of this abuse. He's deserving of his pain. And she buys into it fully. She permission bases, as does her sister, permission base, McLean. And she tells him when this child, as far as she is concerned, has misbehaved so that further abuse, further brutal aggression can be bestowed on this innocent little boy. We get to July 2018. Dakota's 9 at this point. And so McLean decides to have him homeschooled. Now, we all know why. If you want to abuse somebody fully, you isolate them fully. If you think that somebody's going to find out that you're abusing a child, you don't want that to happen. So you're going to make it damn sure that they aren't going to have eyes on the situation. So they remove this little boy from school. And I do not know how Dakota must have felt in that moment. It must have been the only shred of possibility of survival just snapped away from him. So McLean and Hines, they submit this false educational plan to the authorities, and Hines says that she plans on teaching him herself. Now, we all know that the reason that he's removed is, as I've said, it's to isolate him. The teachers may well have posed a risk to McLean and the girls because they might have said, this is happening, we're noticing these injuries, they're reporting them to the authorities. Now, from this point onwards, it meant that Dakota's at the mercy of his abusers 24/7. McLean is also unemployed. He's home all the time. Dakota's life was a living hell. A continuous, painful, torturous hell. Every single moment of that little boy's waking life was full of pain and fear. He lived in the worst conditions you can imagine. So originally he had his own bedroom. But as soon as McLean's three-year-old brother moves into the property, and of course, listen, we're not blaming McLean's three-year-old brother. He's an innocent child. My God, who knows what would have happened to that child in the future? But certainly when he moves in, Dakota is actually moved out of that room and is sent to the attic. So now he's alienated from the family. That's where he's kept locked. He's made to sleep naked. All his clothes were thrown away. And he just gradually gets to live in more and more squalid conditions. Just this filthy mattress, an old deck chair in the room. Also, the attic became his toilet. So McLean decided that he didn't want this three-year-old brother encountering this smelly, naked Dakota. Even though the only reason that this little boy is smelly and naked is because of what McLean's doing. But again, he's dehumanizing, he's separating him. He's not the same as his three-year-old brother. He's less than, and he treats him less than you would treat an animal, worse than you would treat an animal in any circumstance. And this again is permission basing it. He's different, he's not human. I can do what I want with him. So this little boy, Dakota, enduring this daily agony, isn't even allowed to use the bathroom appropriately. In fact, he's only allowed to use the toilet if the little boy, the three-year-old, is asleep, because he's been told he's not got to see this brother, he's not got to cross paths with him. And that means that, of course, when you need the toilet, you can hold it in for a while, but you can't hold it in permanently. So it means that he's forced to defecate in the attic. And the result of that is that his father beat him and then makes him eat his own feces. Now, understandably, the first reaction that Dakota would give was to downright refuse, because you have an aversion. You don't eat your own feces because it's very, very dangerous. It can make you so, so ill. So he refuses. So McLean puts on a glove and then forced it into Dakota's mouth. And over time, that little boy learned when he defecated in the attic, to eat his own feces because he didn't want to be forced to eat it by his father. It was the lesser of two evils. It was a way of controlling his pain as opposed to having more pain forced upon him. If Dakota was ever even caught out of the attic naked, he was actually accused of showing his body off to a three-year-old. They also started to call him fag and calling girls names. This again, humiliation. The way that he's suggesting that this little child who's so young is sexualized, that he's showing his body off to a three-year-old. That shows you how distorted and disgusting and with respect, paedophilic McLean's mind is. Because believe me, McLean, as far as I am concerned, is a sexual molester of children, without a shadow of a doubt. We get to November 2018, and Dakota ends up getting taken to the Children's Hospital. Now, according to McLean, he'd launched himself from the attic window. That makes sense, doesn't it? You know that a child would launch themselves from the attic window. Let's just think about that for a minute. So if a child throws themselves out of an attic window, putting themselves at grave risk, it's gonna be one of two things. That child's either gonna be desperately trying to escape, in which case I'm gonna think, why does this kid wanna run? What's going on that this kid has put their lives at risk? Or I'm gonna think to myself, there's a potential this child's been pushed. I'm not going to be sitting there thinking, whoa, this is just normal. This is just a normal thing. If I don't have children being admitted to hospital that have thrown themselves from the attic, I don't think it's a normal Tuesday. This is what doctors recommend. They recommend that Dakota undergoes psychological counselling. Yeah. So now the services are blaming Dakota. Now, of course, McLean doesn't follow up on it because if he's talking to a psychologist, kid's probably going to start telling the truth. But what we do know is, bizarrely, McLean did later contact a court because he wanted to inquire about children's services that could deal with badly behaved children. Now, they were advised that there were opportunities, there was therapeutic help available, but he turned it down. Apparently, he just wanted Dakota locking up. Now, this is where I get really upset to some degree because I think, my God, why didn't somebody just react? It's so not normal for a primary caregiver to want that kind of result for a child. Surely somebody's going to be doing some intervention at this moment in time and thinking, what is going on here? This kid's thrown themselves out of a window. This kid's got a father who's constantly deriding their behaviour. This kid's in a situation where the father's actually saying he just wants the kid locking up. This is not a good or suitable scenario for this child to be living in, no matter what. And hey, care may not be great. The system may not be great, but tell you now, if that kid had been locked up, they would have been in such a better position than what we're talking about today. Now, after that incident of him apparently throwing himself, of course, throwing himself from the attic window, McLean ends up boarding up all the windows of the attic and he starts just locking Dakota in there. He was denied clothing, food, light. He was denied access to a bathroom. From the moment that little boy woke up until the early hours of the morning, he was made to stand in excruciating torture poses. If he stopped, he was beaten. The night before Dakota was eventually murdered, McLean was out drinking. When he returned home, this is how he greeted Dakota. He repeatedly punched the 10-year-old little boy hard in the stomach. This is while Hines and Ebert watched on. Dakota starts crying, begs his father, saying, no more. And after this beating by this drunk abuser, this little boy is sent to his filthy attic. The abuse continued to culminate on the day of Dakota's death. It was the 13th December 2019, just 5 days before his 11th birthday, in the month that so many children are just excited about Christmas Day coming up and the love that they'll be shown from their caregivers. And here we are talking about a little boy just shy of his 11th birthday in a month that so many celebrate being murdered. That morning, because of the beating before and all the sustained prior abuse, Dakota could hardly walk. So when Ebert shouts him down to use the bathroom, He literally has to hold on to the wall. He's wobbling. He's falling down. He's just trying to make it down the stairs. And McLean, Hines, and Ibbett, they just all decide it's being dramatic. In fact, they said he was putting on a show. Now, in response to that little boy staggering, that's what we're talking about, staggering from side to side, almost impossible for him to walk at this moment in time, McLean elbows him in the back and then orders him back upstairs for punishment. He made him fold up the deck chair. He made him adopt the torture pose. And Takoda is in such a state by this moment in time that he couldn't move fast. So because he doesn't do exactly what he says in the right speed of time, McLean orders him to lie on his stomach on the floor. And he then stands on the little boy with all his weight, even presses his hands to the ceiling to increase the pressure. And basically, imagine how frail Takoda is. He's basically crushing that little boy's frail body. And after this, he made Takoda adopt that torture pose whilst he just goes downstairs and starts watching TV. Continuing, by the way, to verbally abuse him all the way during this time. And McLean returns to the attic later on because it's still not enough. He's still not happy with the level of abuse that is inflicted on this little boy. So he pours hot sauce onto Takoda's buttocks and onto his anus. And then he just continues the abuse by flinging him around. Flinging him around. This is a child who's been so badly beaten, crushed. Now he's being tortured yet again. And then McLean grabs Takoda by the ears and he drags him down from the attic into the bathroom. He orders Takoda to clean his shorts. The boy can't move properly at this moment in time. And because he isn't moving quickly enough, McLean says that unless he hurries up, he's going to drown him. From the living room, Ebert literally heard head splashing, fighting, this child trying to gasp for air. McLean finally takes Takoda back into the attic. The child at this point is broken, literally broken. He curls into a fetal position on the deck chair. And at this point, McLean anally rapes him with a broken wooden chair leg. He forced that chair leg so deep into that little boy's rectum that it caused absolutely horrific internal injuries. And whilst all that's happening, Ebert just sat and watched it on a monitor. From the comfort of the living room couch, she willingly watched that little boy's rape. And because she didn't have a job, because she had no purpose in life, apart from being a reprehensible excuse for a human, she just goes to bed. So little is she moved by what she's seen. So non-traumatized she has been by what I've just described, that feels traumatizing to describe, let alone to see, before even considering what it would be like to live as Takoda had had to live this way. She goes to bed. She sleeps because absolute losers like her manage to sleep because they don't have a conscience. And she ends up getting woken up suddenly by a sister, and her sister's then saying, look, Takoda's not breathing. Now, after years of failing to help Takoda, you would think in this final moment, maybe, just maybe, the reality of their lack of care, their collusion with abuse would just culminate in a moment where they thought, my God, what can I do? How can I stop this? What can I do to help? But no. No, after all those years of failing, why not just fail him one more time? So they do. They did absolutely nothing. They didn't even bother to call 911. Instead, they just take the three-year-old child out of the property and go. So any chance of saving Takoda's life ended there. All they thought about was themselves. At the time of Takoda's death, he had sustained injuries to almost every single part of his body. And it's only after McLean had been unable to actually rouse him, because he wanted to abuse him more, by the way. This isn't a father who wanted to rouse him because he was trying to figure out whether he was ill. This was a father who decided, I've not had my fun yet. Because believe me, McLean has fun. He enjoys this. He enjoys the destruction of this little child. And he wants more of it. So he goes over to try to rouse him so he can hurt him more, because you can't hurt, as far as he's concerned, a child who's asleep in the way that you want to hurt them, because they're not actually registering the abuse, and he can't rouse him. It's at this point he calls 911. Now, during that call, when you would imagine he would be hysterical, expressing fear about the welfare of his child, even if he had realised that he was the person who'd inflicted those final blows and was realistically going to be charged for that child's murder and abuse, you would imagine some level of emotion by saying, I didn't mean to do this, a recognition, a reflection, an acknowledgement that yes, you had inflicted those blows, but maybe you hadn't realized just the gravity of what you had done. That's not what he does. He just moans about what a horrible child Dakota was, how difficult he is to parent. And when the call handler tells him to administer CPR, McLean said this: it smells real rotten inside his stomach. Yeah, he actually retched and complained because his child was rotting from the inside because of the horrific treatment that he was dealing with. Just thinking of himself and only himself. Investigators are able to quickly establish that McLean had been responsible for physically abusing Dakota for years. But they also realize from the get-go, we're not just dealing with McLean as a perpetrator here. Ebert and Hines, they were complicit in the abuse. They encouraged the abuse. They'd actively participated in his forced isolation. So, whereas Ebert might have thought that she was going to get away with it, no. They were both charged with child endangerment, and rightly so. As far as I'm concerned, chain of causation, they should have been culpable for murder. McLean was charged with 4 counts of child endangerment, 2 counts of felonious assault, and 1 count of rape of a child younger than 13. Following the autopsy and further investigation, the 3 defendants, thank God, faced even more charges. So McLean was charged with his son's kidnap and murder. So the kidnap actually related to the period following Dakota's withdrawal from school and also the confinement in the attic. And Hines and Ebert were facing charges of involuntary manslaughter. All 3 pleaded not guilty to charges against them. All 3. At this point, I'm not going to be able to hold back. I think, you know, with respect, we have all the evidence we require. We have a witness who's told the police exactly what happened to Dakota. Ebert's made it very clear. She's squealed like a bird. So at the end of the day, we have that all on record. Therefore, she's admitted complicity. She's admitted that Hines is involved. She's told them in absolute detail how Dakota has met his doom. The idea that they then plead not guilty to these charges, I'm going to throw it out there. Now, personally, just go with me on this, guys. Just go with me on this, guys. I'm just thinking, you know, as we are all aware, because Ebert has told the police exactly what happened. She's admitted that she was present. She's admitted that Hines was present. She's admitted that Dakota's excuse for a father was the person torturing him. She's told them that it was all on video camera. We know that they are bang to rights. But they're saying not guilty. Oh, it costs a lot of money, doesn't it, to have one of those scenarios in court where we have a jury and defenders and prosecutors and so on and so forth. And I'm just thinking, we give them another chance to think about changing their plea. Are you not guilty? We are not guilty. Are you definitely not guilty? We're totally not guilty. You're on video camera, basically. It's been seen by one of the defendants. They've blamed you for all of it and described in detail how the injuries occurred. Are you certainly not guilty? Totally not guilty. You two, you were present. It's been admitted. Yeah, but we're not guilty. Right. Well, before we go to court, I'm going to give you an offer. The offer is you tell the truth, or we've decided to utilise the creativity of McLean. And we have come up with a series of torture poses that you are going to stand in whilst reflecting on whether this is an appropriate course of action regarding your plea. We're going to do it for, I don't know, a month. Sorry, I digress. I'm just saying, you know, if the cap fits and all that, because it really frustrates me when these kind of perpetrators and monsters think it's all right to spend public money defending their actions when we all know they are guilty as hell. Simple as. Now, the police, of course, obtain a warrant. They search McLean's property, and in that property, they find a taser, four electric dog collars, and a combination lock in the attic. And we all know what they've been used on, don't we? We know that they're not just there because he's got dogs in the basement. We know that it's not to do with his animal control. We know they're there because of what they're going to do to Dakota. Also, they found blood splattered up the walls of the property. That's all evidence of Dakota's abuse, his torture, his confinement. They also found, disturbingly and really upsettingly, lots of family photos on the walls, pictures of pets as well. But there wasn't one photo of Dakota. And whilst there were clothes and toys for the three-year-old in the property, the police were not able to find one toy or one piece of clothing that was actually for a child of Dakota's age. When the police went into the attic where Dakota was basically imprisoned, they were hit by this overwhelming smell. It smelled of urine and feces, and the place was entirely empty, aside from a broken chair, excrement, and books. And when the officers actually opened a locked door in the attic, they found a bloody tarpaulin. This had actually been Dakota's bedding, and that was only when he was actually allowed to use it. They also found a filthy deck chair. We all know what happened to that. Now, meanwhile, an iPad taken from the property, they actually found photos of Dakota in the torture pose. This is why I don't believe that people like McLean and those involved should be allowed to even enter a plea of not guilty. Because they're guilty as hell is even recorded. Dakota's in torture poses on an iPad where they've taken photographs of it. Now, before I move on to the court case, I just want to take a moment to recognise how many missed opportunities have been in this case so far. So, there were multiple welfare checks that had been made because the staff at the school where Dakota went, they knew something horrific was happening. They were excellent staff. They did exactly what they were meant to do. And yet, no action was taken, essentially. So, they informed McLean when the visits were going to happen. So he was prepared. Now, this happens so often, it blows my mind. Recently, been very aware of a case where a child has been reported to social services because the conditions they are living in are deplorable. The child needs removing now. Social services ask this question, do you not like the family? So the intonation being, you must be calling us because you want to cause problems for this family. And secondly, the way that they dealt with that deplorable situation was to get in contact with the family and organise a time to go around. Do you think an abuser is going to sit in a home that hasn't been cleaned or a child that hasn't been prepped when they arrive? You don't arrive knowingly for the abuser. You arrive on a spot check so that you find out what's really happening. You don't prepare an abuser for visits. Nothing to hide, not a problem. Something to hide, you're going to get found out on a spot check. But this doesn't happen. So he's drilled into Dakota, who's being horrifically abused anyway, how he has to behave. Says he has to act happy and tell children's services that nothing is wrong. I mean, for God's sake, what is happening when children's services are doing it? Do they just not want any work? We'll just turn up after informing the abuser to make sure everything looks all right so we don't actually have to do anything else. And I'm sorry if that sounds harsh, but that school called it out and knew, and he should be alive, and he's not alive because no intervention occurred. Remember Dakota's mother, Robin Collins? Well, she also had loads of concerns. She was very worried about his welfare, and on multiple occasions she called, this is including a call to 911 on the 14th of May 2019, 7 months before her little boy was killed. Now, McLean had spoken to the authorities after this, and this is how it was concluded. Dakota is being taken care of, still has behavioral issues. His father appears to be taking care of his needs with no concerns. He explained that Robin was given no custodial rights, but he still allows Dakota to speak with her, and she makes promises she never follows through with. Oh my God. So the fact that she had previously lost custody, that mars the belief system of those involved, and they just positively stroke Dakota's abusive, torturous excuse of a human father. Another massive missed opportunity. Also, authorities have been notified of possible abuse at least a year prior to Robin's call. In May 2018, a worker at Dakota's school had reported concerns about his physical welfare. At this point, where this worker has done absolutely what was correct, McLean removes Dakota from school, claims he's ill. But the school employee really suspects that there was being abuse within the household. Now, the police had subsequently called at Dakota's home for a welfare check, but no one answered. And you know how they dealt with that? This kid who's been reported by the school, where they're really concerned that there is abuse going on, where this child has suddenly been removed from the educational system. And they go around and they knock on and no one answers, and they just don't bother to follow it up. They just don't bother to follow it up. Now, according to Dakota's teachers at school, they reported concerns of abuse 17 times to child services. Shame on those child services. Shame on any of you working that case. Shame on any of the authorities that knew that these reports were being filed and did nothing about it. Shame on you. We talk about culpability, and in this case, there is culpability on the services side. In November 2019, it's just a month before Dakota's death, McLean had called 911. Now, this is mind-blowing to me, and again, shows you how little he had value for this child. He doesn't think he's going to get into trouble. He completely believes that there are no consequences to behaviour. So he feels quite comfortable speaking to 911 because he's going to blame his child for the way he's acting. So he's been torturing this child, subjecting him to the most heinous and horrific of abuse, but he feels comfortable complaining to the police that Dakota's talking crazy and not listening. Do you know what's bizarre? The police actually responded to this call. Don't respond to welfare checks. Don't do their job where they can protect a child, but get a dad calling saying, I'm not happy with the way this kid's acting and I'm going to be there quick smart as a copper. And it seems that they were on the verge of taking Dakota to a juvenile centre on account of his alleged bad behaviour. Not behaviour they'd seen, not behaviour they could acknowledge had actually happened, because this excuse of a male had called them to complain. Can you believe that? Now, I wish he'd been taken to that juvenile centre. God damn it, if only that had occurred. The police failed there as well. But the very fact is the blame culture of this little boy. However, he doesn't end up getting sent to the juvenile centre because instead, McLean decides to send him to hospital. They want him to be looked at for behaviour analysis. Now, as it happened, he doesn't engage with any future behavioural analysis. He doesn't engage with the treatment plan. But the police literally were going to take Dakota to put him in juvenile centre because they believed everything that McLean said. Imagine for somebody with this kind of personality that McLean has, this is validation. This is permission. Even the police think he's a terrible kid. Look what was going to happen. And the fact he doesn't send him to juvenile centre is because he doesn't want anybody to actually be able to see the abuse without a doubt. But all the authorities in this moment in time are conspiring against this child. It's unbelievable that Dakota's abuse wasn't identified when the police came round, given his dire physical condition, given the stench in the house. There were multiple opportunities to save this kid. Multiple times that these opportunities were missed by authorities. And yet, when it comes down to attending reports of alleged bad behaviour for a 10-year-old boy, the police are all on it. Even though that boy had a father who'd been reported multiple times for suspected child abuse. Shame on them. Shame on them. And unbelievably, it gets worse, guys. Just 4 days after Dakota's death, Hines, his girlfriend, sets up a GoFundMe page. Yeah, she claims that it's a memorial for Dakota. This is what the caption read. I asked all my friends and family to please share this post. I need all the help I can get. Bullshit. The reality is she wanted to raise money for McLean. She wanted to raise money for her partner who's in custody at the time. And in the recordings of phone calls between the two, we have a tearful McLean. Oh dear, McLean, is it difficult in prison? Are you upset in prison? Is it hard for you in prison? Oh dear. Yeah, he's complaining how dangerous and violent it was in his jail. I hope it is dangerous. I hope it is so. Now, they both know that they're being recorded when they're taking these phone calls. And one of the things that they do is a lot of play acting where they're both protesting their guilt and saying how innocent they are. And it's just so childish and ludicrous. I mean, they actually, as far as I'm concerned, in their heads believe that by protesting their guilt and by claiming their innocence, the authorities are going to be like, oh, can you believe it? I actually think we've like judged Hines and McLean far too quickly. Totally. I mean, when they set up that GoFundMe and basically it was going to be spent on McLean's defense and protecting him in prison, I was like, wow, these people are guilty. But then I heard the phone calls. Totally. When she was saying that they'd been great parents, and there was nothing more they could have done. Yeah. And when he was saying that he just spanked Dakota because he wanted to stop him hurting himself. I mean, all of a sudden I saw things totally differently. Now I realize they probably are not guilty. Me too. What we should do with anybody we suspect of being guilty is we should get them to have conversations with another person who knows of their potential guilt, and we should listen to whether they say they're innocent on the phone. And if they say they're innocent, we should let them go. God, you're really good at this. I know. I also sometimes work on the parole board. Sorry for my sarcasm. I digress a little bit there. Anyway, this is what they're doing, and McLean's even suggesting, like I said, that the only reason he spanked Dakota was because he didn't want to hurt himself. So again, we've got this consistent theme, he's blaming Dakota for his own death. And throughout the whole investigation, I said this right at the beginning and I'm reinforcing it now, all the way through, McLean says that he's the victim. He and Hines even went so far as to ask each other, what more could we have done for this child? They asked this of Dakota, who was beaten and abused every single day. Made to stand in torturous positions every single day. Locked in an attic, forced to eat his own feces, raped with a chair leg. What more could we have done for him? Unbelievable. And Hines goes through and constantly reassures this monster of a parent that he could never have been a better dad. He was a good person. And they even went so far as to say that if Dakota were able, he would speak for them. Seemingly missing the point, because Dakota doesn't have a voice anymore because you stole it, you murdered him, he'll never speak again. And there's even this bizarre irony where they're absolutely incensed that McLean's three-year-old brother has been removed from Hines' custody. They can't believe it. They can't understand that after basically killing a child over a prolonged period of time would stop them from being allowed to have custody of that other child. Now, surprisingly, authorities at this point realise that she isn't a fit mother. I mean, it's taken all this time. It's literally taken the murder of a child, even though there are all these opportunities that have been missed. But now, finally, they've realised she's an unfit mother. Now, during all those hours of taped conversation, neither of them at any point expressed any remorse, any sympathy, any sadness towards Dakota. All they did was defend themselves, remind themselves that they were good people, tell themselves that they were victims. They expressed only concern for themselves and each other. No sorrow about Dakota's death at all. In fact, McLean went so far as to moan about his hard bed and cold meals in prison. Those were conditions of luxury compared to the living hell that Dakota experienced every single day. I don't think he deserved a bed. I certainly don't think he deserved a meal. Maybe someone should have made him eat his own feces like he'd done to his child. Now, when it comes to court, all three defendants ultimately do take plea deals. So 27th of May, 2020, Hines' sister, Ebba, she pleads guilty to involuntary manslaughter and multiple counts of child endangerment. She's actually sentenced from 8 to 12 years in prison. Hines also pleaded guilty to manslaughter and also multiple counts of child endangerment. Now, she was sentenced to 22 to 27 and a half years in prison. Amen to that sentence. Amen to that sentence. There was a maximum possible sentence of 30 years. I would have happily seen her experience and endure that. But I still think that 22 to 27 years is a good sentence. She didn't physically lay her hands on that child, but at the end of the day, she had a chance to stop it and she encouraged the abuse. She is culpable without a doubt. Now, days before his trial was due to commence, McLean pleaded guilty. He pleaded guilty to murder, rape, kidnapping, and child endangerment. So on September 2021, he's sentenced to 51 years to life in prison, and God damn it, let that be life. Let him take his last breath, ideally in agony, in a cold cell by himself. Also, he gets listed as a tier 3 sex offender. So if he were ever to get out, which as I said, he won't, he would not be able to be within a distance of children, literally. Anywhere near kids, it wouldn't be allowed. So in September 2021, McLean is sentenced to 51 years to life in prison. God damn it, let him die, taking his last breath in agony in a cell by himself. He's also listed as a tier 3 sex offender, as he should be. Now, during sentencing, Montgomery County Common Pleas Court Judge Dennis Adkins stated this: "You provided no mercy to your son, and you deserve none from this court." So true. Amen to that. No mercy. He actually referred to McLean's actions as evil, pure evil. It's unbelievable to me, because I'm telling you this case, and yet throughout the entire scenario that I've talked about today, none of the defendants expressed any remorse for their part in Takoda's torture and death. And I mean, not a moment, not a moment. Now, Takoda's family, they later filed a lawsuit against Montgomery County. That was in October 2021, when a settlement of $3.25 million was reached. Now, that largest portion of that money goes to Takoda's three siblings, half-brothers and sisters. His mother and his grandmother also received a portion. I imagine that's because at the end of the day, his mother didn't have a good start, but she certainly tried to protect him, and the grandmother certainly tried to protect him, tried to get custody. So even though money does not resolve anything at all, the point is, where authorities are concerned, it's the only way you can hurt them a little, because money does hurt the authorities. You know, they don't like paying out substantial amounts of money, but it doesn't bring him back. And it certainly doesn't make up for the horrific and heinous years of torture that he endured. This has been an absolutely horrific case. You know, somehow Takoda's sustained abuse was allowed to continue for years. This is despite the fact that authorities had received multiple reports from people concerned about his welfare. McLean was able to isolate his victim, and it was easy for him. It was simple for him. When staff at his school attempted to get help for Takoda, McLean just responded aggressively. He demanded that he didn't see the school nurse. He made sure that welfare checks weren't properly followed up. And when child services did attend the property, McLean ensured that Takoda acted happy. When he suspected the school of actually reporting him, what he did was he removed Takoda from the school so that there was no hope for that child. He used the homeschooling him system as an opportunity to isolate him further. He knew how to manipulate the system per se. McLean isolated and systematically abused his victim at will for years, and all the warning signs were there. Takoda was a victim of serious abuse, and no one saved him, in spite of all the signs being there. He was failed by everyone. Most of all, he was failed by those whose role it was to love and to care for him. I shouldn't be telling you this story today. Takoda should be a thriving teen, a child looking forward to Christmas after just celebrating his birthday, full of hope, possibility, opportunity. But instead, he had that future stolen from him by the very people that were meant to love and protect him. I wish horror for those humans. I wish every single night for their dreams to be haunted by terror. I hope they sleep terribly for the rest of their days. I hope they never know the warmth of another human touch. I hope for those women who allowed that little boy to be tortured and murdered in front of them, no love for the rest of their lives until one day, hopefully, and I truly believe this, they'll be judged beyond their wildest fears for what they did to that child. I'm going to dedicate this to Dakota. I would like to take a moment for us all to just think about a little boy lost and the appalling failures that led to this child not having the opportunity to be here today. This is for Dakota. Take care, guys. Be safe. And remember, if you ever think that a child is being abused like this, risk offending, call social services again and again and again and again, and don't let them tell you that you have the problem when you know that these things go on in our neighborhoods. Risk offending. We can save lives. RIP Dakota. Fly high, sweetheart.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. If you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. Choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus terms and conditions apply.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step 1. Go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step 2. Collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step 3. Play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games. All for free?
Step 4. Unleash your excitement.
Woohoo!
Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. Funny thing about being fast, you end up waiting a lot. First to show up, first in line, then just waiting. Me, I rev up Chumba Casino. With over 200 social casino games, no slow lanes here. Why sit around when you can spin? I'm already racing. Your turn. Play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. That's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together, because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Do you love true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries?
If so, you gotta check out our podcast, True Crime Obsessed, where we recap the true crime documentaries everybody's watching.
We say everything you're thinking and probably screaming at your TV.
We've been at the top of the podcast charts for almost 9 years, and we have over 400 episodes for you to check out right now.
We cover the cases everyone's talking about, and we also highlight the cases that have been underreported, overlooked, or forgotten.
With over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, if you've never checked out True Crime Obsessed, now's the time to give us a try.
Find True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.